This Strategy and Business podcast was produced in conjunction with Knowledge at Wharton. As healthcare costs skyrocket, employers are finding it increasingly difficult to offer comprehensive health benefits, and the burden of healthcare financing is gradually shifting to the consumer. According to experts at Booz Allen Hamilton, consumers will need to meet this challenge by planning for their healthcare costs as they do for their other financial expenditures, by tapping into products aligned with the financial services life planning cycle. Strategy and Business and Knowledge at Wharton recently spoke with Joni Bessler, Vice President at Booz Allen Hamilton, and Kent Smetters, Professor of Insurance and Risk Management at Wharton, about what this health-wealth convergence could look like. In this second part of a three-part interview, Bessler and Smetters discussed the potential impact of a health-wealth convergence on employers and employees, and how providers might structure plans that could address both individual and group markets.
Taking a look, maybe a little farther out, you know, if this healthcare and financial planning convergence it does indeed take hold, and there are radical changes, what will that look like for employers? Let's start with employers. What will that look like for employers in terms of benefits, the kinds of plans that are offered? I mean, would they be strictly HSA, HRA?
I think the first thing that we would say is we need to be careful that we don't talk about employers as a one-size-fits-all, because employers segment as well in how they think about health benefits. So you've got employers that actually do see it as a recruitment and retention strategy because their industries demand it, or because philosophically they're still in a more paternalistic mode. You've got other employers that want to continue to offer health care but would like to see more toward a defined contribution as opposed to a defined benefit model. And then you've got other employers that, frankly, if they had their druthers, would get out of the business of healthcare altogether. So it segments. So when you talk about what does this look like, it's probably a somewhat tailored answer depending on the segment. That said, you know, if you play it out to its extreme, from the employer's standpoint, they would stop thinking about healthcare as a separate benefit. So all the benefits now integrate. So it's not dissimilar to what, you know, Kent was talking about earlier. As an employer, you know, most of us have some sort of pension program. Many of us have the options of other benefits. We've heard cafeteria-style benefits kicked around over the years. You've got your health care, which sometimes is in and sometimes is out. And the idea is that all those benefits could be integrated so that as the employer is offering a benefits package, it's an integrated package of a full suite of benefits.
I really don't have anything to add. I think that's exactly right. I think you're going to see HSAs certainly become more popular. Worse, how employers can, I think, differentiate themselves a little bit is really how much they contribute toward that deductible. If you really wanted to replicate kind of an old first dollar type coverage, the employer could contribute a lot toward that deductible.
And would that then become an incentive for employees?
Recruitment,
for instance?
It would, in the sense that the employee would still, however, at the margin, recognize that if I go to the doctor, this is still my money that I'm spending. Even though the employer contributed to that deductible, it's still his money because that's consumption they're giving up at the point of retirement, because that's consumption that they could have converted to non-health type consumption at retirement. So it's still the analogy here would be the way employers used to pay for employees when they traveled. They would say, submit your receipts and we'll just reimburse you. And so what the employees do, they go for the nice hotel, they don't go for the little economy car, they go for the nice car and so forth. The employers kind of got smart and they said, you know, maybe we should just do this per diem. Now, we'll take an average hotel cost, average car cost, we'll give you a per diem. And now what they see is that employees now go for the cheaper hotel, they go for the cheap economy car, because it's now their money. And so from the employee's perspective, they're better off. They value the extra cash. The employer is better off because they get to save some money on the reimbursements, because they're not paying for that 4 or 5 star hotel anymore. They're paying for a 3, 3.5 star hotel. Both parties are better off just because the incentives are more aligned.
Let me add one other comment, Stephen. It picks up on something Kent mentioned earlier. You know, what does it look like for employers? The other piece of this puzzle is what employers are going to have to offer that they actually don't have to offer today. So if you play this model out and we've put more responsibility into the hands of the consumer, there is a set of services that the consumer is going to need in order to be able to make informed healthcare decisions. Yeah. Or we're going to have exactly the issues that you alluded to earlier around 401k. Things like just advisory services to understand what this really is. You know, what does it mean for me and what choices am I making? Planning tools so that the employee actually knows how much money they need to fund at various points of their life cycle. You know, those sorts of things and the like.
Yeah, and that point is absolutely crucial because we saw an analogy of this in retiree saving as opposed to retiree health. With the shift over the 401ks, what we've seen is multiple errors on the point of employees that we never had to worry about in the old defined pension benefit world where the employer kind of took care of everything. So what we see in 401ks is when sometimes employees don't even participate, or they'll participate up to the match of the employer and they won't do anything more than that. Or their asset allocation is really bizarre. They think they diversify by taking the five different funds that the employer or the defined contribution plan offers and dividing it, their money, what we call the 1/N rule. They'll put 20% in the five different funds, and they say, well, I'm diversifying, not recognizing that four of the five funds are actually equity funds investing in the exact same thing. And so there's all these types of errors that are being made that wouldn't have been made in the old defined benefit model where they were employees didn't have to be the experts. Now, as we shift for retiree health into this defined contribution world, there's going to have to be a lot of education and so forth. The alternative to that, or the complement to that, is to come up with automatic type of rules, or what we call default options, that we're now talking about with retiree health, where now we're saying with retiree health is that we don't really expect employees to know how to sign up for this thing. We're going to sign them up automatically. And we're going to also put them in a lifestyle or life cycle type fund automatically. And then we'll tell them, by the way, if you don't like this, you can opt out. But we're going to force you to do a little paperwork. So you change the complete default from putting a burden on the employee to try to figure it out to put it on the employer to automatically enroll them. And that requires some legislative change because those changes, in fact, did happen a little bit with some recent laws. It requires probably a little more to do it right. One of the concerns employers used to have in the old days, well, gee, if I put my employees in a stock fund and then the fund underperforms, could they sue me? Because I just expose them at risk. And now with the new Pension Act, some of that's been resolved. And so we kind of need automatic rules also for healthcare as well.
Joni, how can payers structure plans that address both the individualized market and group markets?
I wouldn't start with the segmentation of individual versus group. Mm-hmm. I know that's been the segmentation of the past. And it's largely a segmentation that evolved because of the way healthcare was purchased. But if you take a look at how segmentation is unfolding, it's unfolding much more now around the characteristics of the consumer. And I mentioned earlier that the young population, the young healthy population looks very different than the mature adult, that looks very different than the young families or the early retirees versus the late retirees. So as we think about segmentation now, we're thinking about it more from the standpoint of the life cycle of the individual and the unique healthcare needs of that individual. So to answer your question, as we think about plan design, we would increasingly counsel our clients to think about plan design against the various life cycle segments.
Which is actually taking a leaf from the financial services industry, correct?
Yes, although to be fair to the health industry, the concept of segmentation and segmenting around the characteristics of the ultimate consumer as opposed to the employer who was the buyer also emerged, you know, about a decade ago. So I would say those segmentations are converging as the industries are converging.
Just at the, on the level of providers, doctors, hospitals, how would this kind of change affect them?
I was waiting for that question because we've talked a lot about the demand side. We've talked a lot about the restructuring of the demand side, the shift from a wholesale to a retail, and actually, and that's progressing. The piece where we feel major reform is still needed is on the supply side. And for all the right reasons, the doctors in particular have been very slow to come to the table around this shift. And if you put yourself in, your, in their shoes, you can understand it. They did not join medicine so that they could be worrying about the alphabet soup of HSAs and HRAs and deductibles and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We did some work. We, Booz Allen, did some work, which I guess now, Amy, is about a year and a half old, where we talked to doctors about how they viewed the shift toward the retail environment, and in particular, CDHPs, consumer-directed health plans, HSAs. And what was interesting is that they saw it as the most significant shift for them over the next 3 to 5 years, more important than pay for performance, more important than the docs in the boxes that we see in the Walgreens. You know, they really do see it as a fundamental shift to how healthcare is going to be delivered. But when you talk to them about the data requirements that are going to be needed so that the consumer can make the decisions they need to make, so the cost of the service, the outcome, which drugs have the right or not the right, but have the desired clinical outcome, you know, some of that sort of data, the expectation that they will be providing that data over the next set of years is actually quite low. The percentages are very low. They do not see themselves as providing that data to the public, at least in the near term.
Yeah, and that's a very important point, that if the consumers are now actually face the marginal cost of their healthcare, they're going to want to know what's the cost, what's the benefit. In the old days, they didn't have to worry about the cost. They were just told, this is your, either your, you pick a doctor from this group and you're pretty much fine with the outcome. But now that they face the cost, they're going to actually think about cost-benefit analysis. So they actually need good quality information to make this choice. The problem is doctors, they don't want to provide this information. And one reason why is because concerns about liability. You provide information, it doesn't, maybe you don't look so good relative to your peers. Now, if you're sued for an operation gone bad, they can make establish a case. You're a bad doctor. Look at the time series of the information. And it could be the case that the there's pure sample selection bias that's going on. That doctor happens to get the worst patients because he's actually or she's actually the best doctor in that area, and they happen to get the sicker patient loads. So the concerns about liability is very important. This has always been a trade-off I would call it perversity of U.S. law, and that is by being a good citizen and providing information, that information can now be used against you. And so it's kind of, we need kind of a Fifth Amendment equivalent in the business world, where if I'm being a good citizen and I'm providing information about outcomes, about efficacy and things like that, that information should not then be in turn used against me.
And then to exacerbate even that, we don't necessarily even have the standards against which to collect comparable data. So today, the collection of data and how that data is portrayed is very much left to the individual institution or even the individual doctor. And the need is to be able to compare across providers for similar similar needs. So if I, you know, take a very simple example, if I want to go have a baby and it's a planned normal delivery, you know, what's it going to cost from hospital to hospital? And is there any reason to believe there's going to be any clinical difference? And therefore, you know, what am I prepared to trade off? And am I prepared to share a room versus being in a private room if it's going to cost me X versus Y? You know, am I prepared to have this sort of doctor versus that sort of doctor, et cetera, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. And when you have people who won't even opt into a plan because they think they'll never get sick or never retire or get old, so how do you even begin to address the need that employees, for instance, will have to educate themselves about these things? I mean, how can that be tackled? Would that be done through employers, or would there be centralized sources for information that, that people can turn to for that kind of clinical data? And how would those sources be vetted?
Well, there are niche players already who see this as a huge opportunity and are being very aggressive in the collection and the assimilation of that data. So it's not that the need hasn't been recognized, and it's not that there aren't players who are now trying very hard to collect that data. I think the second part of your question, though, is how do you get the employee or the consumer to internalize the need for that data and to act on it is very much going to be an education process. And frankly, as you know, as we put more responsibility on them and they are taking more risk, they're actually not going to have much choice.
Yeah. One slight difference between retiree health and retiree saving is that if I, as an employee, put away money today for retirement saving, and I completely misspoke. It's not necessarily retiree health, it's just health in general versus retiree saving. But if I put money aside today for retiree saving, that's consumption I'm giving up today. Whereas if we're talking about healthcare, even it's pre-retiree health, if I get that healthcare plan, then I get that healthcare plan, even if it's a large deductible. Well, if I didn't have that plan, I'm still facing a large deductible per se. It's all the cost. And so that plan is not costing me anything more. It's not like I'm foregoing consumption because I would have to pay that deductible either way, where I had a plan or no plan. So there should be incentives for people to still sign up for the healthcare plan with large deductible. So hopefully that is nothing more than just reminding them sign up for this plan, or just automatically enrolling them, not even giving them the option, not even forcing them to make any type of intertemporal trade-off.
For more insights about management, innovation, public policy, strategy, and more, visit Strategy and Business at www.strategy-business.com. For more business research and analysis from Knowledge at Wharton, visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.